like show business, like no business I know. Everything about it is appealing, everything the traffic will allow.
You're listening to Because You Watched with Charlie and Francesco. I'm Charlie.
And I'm Francesco.
This is a podcast where we take a film that enjoyed significant mainstream success and use them as a starting point to discuss lesser-known films that we think deserve greater attention. But this is a special episode. We're not doing that this time. In fact, what we're doing instead is discussing the... What's the word for every 10 years?
Decennial? No, that doesn't sound right.
Every decade, Sight and Sound magazine comes out with their 100 greatest films of all time list, and we thought, since it came out last week, this would be a good opportunity for us to discuss it, our thoughts, and films on it that we've always meant to see and never have, or films that we've never even heard of that look interesting.
Yeah. So should we start with how many films of this year's list have you seen?
As of this morning, I've seen 41.
Okay, I'm at 86. So okay. A bit further ahead than you, but we can still discuss quite a little bit. What I think is most interesting about this film is obviously the top spot, but we'll save that for last. What do you think about the list overall? Good, bad, agree, disagree?
Well, there's nothing... This is the problem. There's nothing really to disagree with.
Yeah.
It's not... I think a lot of people have misinterpreted this list as Sight and Sound saying these are the 100 best films of all time. Mm-hmm. When what it actually is a bunch of critics and directors being asked to say, what are your 10 favourite films? What 10 films do you think are best? And then adding them all together and see which films come up the most. There's not one person at the BFI moving stuff around like a reality show to try and annoy people who are big David Lean fans.
but I will say that although I don't agree or disagree with it, I was happy with this year's list.
Why were you happy with it? Is it just because you could say that you'd seen a lot of them?
Yeah, but like, you know, because I've seen a lot of them, I had a clear image in mind of what the list looked like, and all of the films on it, I was happy that they were there. I was happy that there were was more of a focus on films that haven't been on similar lists before, and that some films that were on the list already but quite low have been sharp higher. And just overall, and this is probably more about the top 10 itself than the list overall, I like when these lists change. You know, Citizen Kane was the number one for what, 5 decades, when they were just interviewing like 50 people in total. Now that they've expanded that to 1600 interviewees, I'm happy that there's a different film at number one, and there's different films in the 90s, and there's different films in the 50s.
I will say that Citizen Kane wasn't the top film last time.
No, but it was Vertigo. Yeah. It was the top one for 5 decades between 1962 and 2002.
Whereas now the film in the top spot is, you can pronounce it better than I can, because it's a long title.
Jean Dillman, 23, Quai du Commerce, 1080 Bruxelles, or yes. Brussels.
Which we're going to talk about a bit later. I kind of had the opposite reaction to you. I was happy with it, but for the opposite reasons. When I see a list like this, I'm far more excited if I haven't seen most of them, because now I have a starting point for new films to watch, rather than, not this is what you're doing, but being able to be happy at how well-educated I am in film history.
Well, I guess the word for me was vindicated.
Yes, I can imagine. Yeah. Vindicate. I asked you, did you feel vindicated? Because you love that film.
But yeah, no, I don't think there's a film on the list that I haven't heard of. So this is not a list for me to find out about new things, for sure. But it is a list for me to like reconsider some things that maybe I've seen in the past or I haven't seen yet, and kind of forcing me to go around to finally watching them.
What were your biggest surprises in the list?
Portrait of a Lady on Fire being number 30 was probably my biggest surprise. It's less about films that were included and more about their spots. Like certainly Jean Dillman being number one, I don't think anyone saw that coming. In retrospect, it makes sense, and we'll talk about that later. But just Portrait of a Lady on Fire being number 30, just because I was expecting more contemporary films to be on there, but a film that is 3 years old to be so high, as it happens, since I think the very first time they made the list in 1952, when the number one was Bicycle Thieves, that at the time was only 3 years old.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I think I can understand why newer releases are surprising to people, because we don't tend to think of them as classics, but without realizing that it's lists like this that might inspire people to search out these films and let them become classics.
Yeah, and it's also, I think, the core fault in the formula where critics are asked to name the 10 best films of all time. So a lot of them naturally follow what is more canonically or more historically important and tend to go for more classical films. But a lot of them interpret that as, I don't think there's anything like that's objectively good. So I'm going to nominate the films that speak the more to me as an individual. And that's where you start getting more contemporary films.
Are there any films that you are sad weren't included on the list?
There is one, which I don't know if it was on the list before I don't think so, but Spring in a Small Town by Fame. Because I think with these lists, I don't expect to see my personal favorites on there. So I could say, oh, I was disappointed that like this film I like and this other film I like wasn't on there. Spring in a Small Town is one of those films that is like, it's kind of considered in inverted commas, the Citizen Kane of China, like the greatest Chinese film ever made. And for it to not be high in the canon of what is a very international poll, feels a bit like it should be on there. I don't know. It's one of those things that definitely should be on there to the same level as Tokyo Story or Citizen Kane or any Hitchcock. But somehow it never broke through. Although when reading a lot of the directors' individual lists, so many East Asian directors voted for it.
These lists are really interesting as a snapshot in time. And the fact that they commit to doing a new one and a broader one every 10 years means that even if you don't like what's on the list, just wait a bit and don't vote for it again. You know, it's the chance to see what people are considering classics at a particular moment and viewing it as a living historical document rather than the Ten Commandments down from Mount Sinai.
But what about you? What is the film that wasn't on the list that you wanted to be on the list?
Well, I think it'll come as no surprise to you that that film is... Actually, there are a few. The first one is Network, which I think is the greatest film ever made. Mm-hmm. But I won't talk too much about that because also anyone that knows of it, it doesn't need my help. It's very well-known film. I would say that I wish Alien was on the list instead of Blade Runner.
That makes sense.
Because we've talked a lot about Blade Runner on the episode on that film, and that there's a lot of stuff that we don't like in it. Even though that it moves the dial in a lot of ways, I think that as a narrative with characters, I think it's very inconsistent. It's not a film I dislike, it's just when there are so many films I love that aren't on that list, and I would much rather have Alien on that list. Mm-hmm. The other thing is like there are other films I don't particularly appreciate but are considered canonical. So The Searchers being on the list, I don't even think it's the best John Ford movie.
And a lot of westerns got knocked out after 2012. That one stayed up there.
Yeah, The Wild Bunch I think is the one a lot of people are talking about. But also the inclusion of Once Upon a Time in the West over The Good, the Bad and the Ugly, which is interesting because you'd think more people have an affinity for that Leone film rather than another. But you know, it's interesting, and it's also a chance to see the consensus of a myriad of perspectives.
Yeah, and just another film I wanted to add to the list of disappointments, just because no films by my favourite director around there, Simon Liang, although quite a lot of people voted for his films, I think they just split the vote. If any of his films was going to be on there, it was probably going to be Goodbye Dragon, which I know has received a few votes, but not enough to make it to top 100.
Would you be open to them limiting the amount of films per director?
I think that I like the way they're doing it because we get lists that are more personal. And I almost enjoy more reading directors and critics' individual lists than I do reading the overall consensus top 100. Because that's where you actually get their opinions and you get a lot of their personality. And there are some voters who are just obsessed with one or two directors and are going to overrepresent them in their top 10. And I think that's fine. I wouldn't do it personally, but I wouldn't disallow it.
No, I think that's right. And it is really interesting over the next few days just seeing people share the individual lists and react and seeing those... Obviously, they're all in the Science Sound magazine, but seeing people react online to specific lists, I think, is really interesting. And just seeing that a lot of people did pick Jean Dielman because they think it's important, and not because they think it's the best film of all time, it's that it's in the list of top 10 films that they think should be on this list.
Yeah.
And it's not the same thing, it's just a lot of people happen to think that it's a very important film, and more so than they did for any other film.
And it's also a film that people who like it, it tends to be very personal to them. I don't know if this is us transitioning into talking about Jean Dielman or into discussing the top 10 overall, but it is one of those films where when you look at the directors who voted for it and the ones that maybe wrote some comments under their choices to justify them, tends to be voted not because of its canonical place in history, although it does have that, like there was no film such as that being made in 1975, but because it is a film that speaks to a lot of people, and I think that them increasing the number of women being interviewed, it speaks quite a lot to women who watched it. I'm not surprised that a lot of women ended up voting for it and it shot up to number one because of that.
Another disappointment for me is just the lack of musicals.
Yeah.
Not only do I really like musicals, but I think it's so integral to the development of film as a, not just a visual medium, as a sound medium. I understand Singing in the Rain being there, but I would have liked to have seen stuff that also contributed to that journey. It's not like Singing in the Rain happened and it was one and done.
Yeah.
Also, it's definitely not the first. I think if you were going to go for one that sort of creates the movie musical, I'd go for more of a Busby Berkeley film.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I personally go for Cabaret, but that's my personal favourite.
I love Cabaret, yeah. But I'm just saying that if you were going for one that really creates the movie musical, yeah, it's not Singing in the Rain.
No.
I think we have time to just go over the top 10.
Yeah.
So number one, Jean Dillman, which we'll talk about later. Number two, Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo.
Yeah, which, would that be the Hitchcock you pick if you were to pick one?
If I was to pick a film by Hitchcock in the top 10 or the only Hitchcock to be on the list?
Like, if you were to put a Hitchcock film in your personal top 10, would you pick Vertigo?
It would probably be Rear Window for me.
Same, actually.
I just think that the limitations placed on the storytelling really allow Hitchcock to show what he can do in terms of framing a narrative all from one room and how one person sees the world. But I really like Vertigo, and I also understand why a lot of people react to it.
Mm-hmm.
Number three, Citizen Kane, which we've talked a bit about.
I think...
good film.
Yeah. Underrated, no. But Citizen Kane, I think that you don't really get a sense of how truly monumental that film is if you haven't watched films made in the same period under the studio system, and you truly understand how much it sticks out like a sore thumb because of how just inventive it is in its form. So a lot of people watching it now in the context of like how much further contemporary cinema has gotten ever since the 50s and 60s, don't really get why critics tend to just, you know, adore it so much, because a lot of, especially American critics, will have seen a lot of those studio productions from the 40s and will regard Citizen Kane as like the golden goose among them.
Yeah. Okay, so number four is Tokyo Story by Yasujiro Ozu,
which I was fully expecting to win when there were rumors that the number one wasn't going to be an American film or a film in the English language anymore. Also because Tokyo Story was number one in the director's list in 2012. And yeah, I love that film so much.
I think it's great. Is it the film you would recommend to someone that wanted to get into Japanese cinema and had only seen Kurosawa films?
No, probably not. It's probably the film I would recommend to someone who wanted to get into Ozu. But even then, it's kind of the third in a series. It's kind of a mature Ozu film. I saw the film twice. I saw it once when I hadn't seen any other Ozu films, and it took me a second to like get into it and vibe with the style. Then I rewatched it after having seen a bunch of earlier Ozus, and that's when I finally got it. So no, I wouldn't suggest people start off with Tokyo Story straight away. I think if you know Japanese cinema and you're all into Kurosawa, you should probably go for someone like Kobayashi, who also makes genre-oriented cinema, or Mizoguchi, who also makes samurai adjacent, like, you know, Shinto period films.
Yeah, or if you're looking for something more modern, you can go for Ryosuke Hamaguchi, director of Drive My Car and Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy.
Yeah, or Hirokazu Koreeda, who's often considered like the contemporary, basically, heir to Yasujiro Ozu.
Yeah, and that's not even going into Studio Ghibli and all the great animators working in Japan.
Yeah, but you assume people know of them.
Well,
and Studio Ghibli had two entries in this
list. I know they did.
We haven't spoken about that.
Yeah, My Neighbor Totoro and Spirited Away.
Yeah.
Neither of which are my favourite. I love them both very dearly, but I would have loved to have seen Kiki's Delivery Service on there.
Or Princess Mononoke, but I'm happy that Studio Ghibli made their debut in the list.
Yeah.
And that just animation was a bit more considered this year, even though not enough, probably.
Number five is Wong Kar-wai's In the Mood for Love. No complaints from me. Absolutely boiling hot film.
Yeah. I have some complaints with some of the rest of Wong Kar-wai's filmography, but In the Mood for Love, if any 21st century film was going to be there, it was going to be that one, probably.
And just if you're a very thirsty person, Maggie Cheung and Tony Leung are extremely attractive in this film.
And in every film.
Yes, but I think this film is the zenith of their powers.
Yes.
So, yeah, that is a very good film for horny people. 2001 A Space Odyssey, you know why it's good.
Yeah, I saw it on 70mm IMAX a few years ago. Just the Stargate sequence is just... It's quite something when watched like that.
Actually, I don't gel with 2001 as much as I gel with some other Kubricks, even though I really like it. I just think that The Shining and Barry Lyndon have, which are on the list, there's a rawness there and more of an interest in humans that I just don't think 2001 does, and that's not the point of it.
Mm-hmm.
But for that reason, it's not the Kubrick I'd put in the top 10.
Yeah.
Number seven, Beau Travail, a film I haven't seen.
I have seen it quite a few years ago now. I remember when I first saw it. It took me a while to get it, but fortunately I did watch it as part of a uni screening. So, you know, that comes with a seminar, it comes with the lecturer explaining why they picked it. And it's just again, one of those films that is about the monotonous rhythms of life, and it's about human bodies. It's less about character, and it's less about narrative, and it's less about drama. So it's certainly a film that I wasn't expecting to see in the top 10. I'm happy it's there, and a lot of people should seek it out if they're looking for like different kinds of cinematic expressions.
Yeah. Number 8, David Lynch, Mulholland Drive.
Yeah.
Great film. I can also understand why a lot of critics, particularly younger critics, it might have been their first introduction to a sort of new form of storytelling.
Yeah.
In film. So I wouldn't have necessarily thought it would make the top 10, but I'm not surprised at all that it's there. I think if I was going to vote for Lynch, I'd choose The Elephant Man.
Oh, that's good, yeah.
I think it gets to the heart of what Lynch is interested in without all of the stuff that you might stereotypically call Lynchian.
Yeah. I'd probably go with Twin Peaks, Fire Walk With Me, because I'm not allowed to vote for The Return, because boring. But again, I don't think that Fire Walk With Me works on its own. It works better in the context of Twin Peaks as a series.
All right, number 9, Man with a Movie Camera, directed by Zsigmond Vertov.
I mean, that's one of those films that has to be on there. It kind of has to be in the top 10 of like most objectively best films of all time. And it's still a film that like if you watch it nowadays, it can be wildly entertaining, just the exploration of the technology of filmmaking in that time. Like if you're interested in the history of film, not only as a storytelling medium, but also as a technology, this is a film that you absolutely have to watch.
And number 10, I think the only musical, Singing in the Rain.
Yeah.
Directed by Stanley Donen and Gene Kelly, which we've talked a bit about before. I love Singing in the Rain. I think it's a great film. I think it deserves to be on this list. I just wish it wasn't the only musical.
Yeah, and I can see why it's in the top 10, especially because it is a film that parodies and critiques and reframes the history of Hollywood. And a lot of critics really, really enjoy that, the aspect of it, together with it being part of like one of the canonical Hollywood genres. But yeah, personally, I wouldn't have put it in the top 10 if I were to make this list myself.
And if you were going to choose one musical, as you said, it wouldn't be that.
No.
No, I just don't think there's really a story in it, which, I mean, just from a narrative perspective, I don't love it.
Yeah, but you know, we just had the Beau Travail and Man with a Movie Camera. I don't need to have a story, so I think that's the least of its problems.
That's true. So, before we move on, the other thing I wanted to mention is there are films, not just new films on the list, but films that came out after the last list. There are 4 films, and they are Get Out, Parasite, Moonlight, and Portrait of a Lady on Fire. If you were to boil down the last 10 years into 4 films, are these the ones you pick?
They make sense, actually. I know we were talking a bit earlier about Get Out, should it be on there or not, but I think Get Out also makes sense because of just the wave it brought with it when it came out, whether you personally like the film or not. Parasite, similarly, it was just so highly regarded by critics that I'm not surprised that so many of them voted for it. Portrait of a Lady on Fire, as I said earlier, like I'm surprised it's so high on the list, but like it'd probably be on my personal list of favorite films of the past decade. I mean, spoilers it is. But and finally, Moonlight as well. Yeah, no, I think these all make sense. I don't know if I would pick this for particularly as encapsulating the entire decade of the 2010s, but I'm not complaining about them either.
No, I almost half expected to see Mad Max Fury Road on the list.
True.
Because critics did really like that.
Yeah.
But I'd be interested to see how the numbers stack up. But yeah, broadly, I'm happy with those. I'm not disappointed Get Out's on the list. I was just surprised to see it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, I wasn't as surprised to see it as you were, I guess, just because I know that, like, in critic circle and academic circle, like, it is a film that was spoken about at length after it came out. Way more so than any of Jordan Peele's, you know, other films. Especially as Nope, it's, you know, literally just came out a couple of months ago.
Okay, so now let's move on to just a bit about Jean Dillman.
Yeah.
This won't be with the same length and depth as we would do in a regular episode, but it's interesting to talk about a bit more about why we, particularly Francesco, thinks it is in the place that it is. Now, Francesco, you, on our first episode of this podcast, you mentioned this film as one of your favourite films.
Well, the question was, we were talking about Gone with the Wind, and we got into a weird diatribe about whether it is a film that you can watch for 4 hours straight without needing a break, whether it justifies its runtime. And when you asked me, what's the film that you would watch for 4 hours straight without a break? I said, Jean Dillman, of course.
Even though it's not 4 hours long.
It's 3.5, 3:20.
It's about 3:20, yeah.
But I would watch it for 4 hours.
I think we have a clip. I think we have a clip of you saying that. It's very confusing. By the way, what are the other movies that you think you could stand for 4 hours?
Jean Dillman, 23, Quai du Commerce, 1080 Bruxelles.
Charlie Nash showing a solid Leo to speak a word of French look there. Is that
panic. So for context, it's a 3-hour movie mostly comprised of scenes of a woman cooking and doing absolutely nothing. One of my favourite films of all time.
Were you accidentally watching the Food Network?
Just the French Food Network, and you thought it was a film.
That might or might not have happened.
What a good clip.
The memories.
Oh, like tears in rain.
But yeah, no, at that time, neither you nor Siobhan, our guest, knew what that film was.
No. And listening back to that clip, you actually describe it fairly well. That it sounded like the most esoteric, not quite boring, but just very slow and monotonous film, which it is, but it really earns its pace.
Yeah, I would say that if you're going to use boring or monotonous to criticize a film, it's appropriate to do so for films that aren't meant to be boring, films that are meant to be entertaining and action-filled. This film makes an aesthetic out of monotony, makes a point out of monotony. And for those who aren't really familiar with what the film is about, the synopsis reads, a lonely widowed housewife does her daily chores, takes care of her apartment while she lives with her teenage son, and turns the occasional trick to make ends meet. Slowly, her ritualized daily routines begin to fall apart. So yeah, we're watching 3 days in this woman's life, being a housewife, and just going through...
And a sex worker.
And a sex worker, which isn't mentioned in the...
No, it is.
Oh, is it?
Turns the occasional trick, that's what that means.
So she turns the occasional trick to make
that's
ends meet.
Yeah, that's... Yeah. So, you're not familiar with that phrase?
I thought it meant... Yeah, that makes sense now. So yeah, and she's a sex worker. Okay, yeah, and...
Part-time,
once a day, at the same time every day. And that's what's so crucial about this film. It's like, her routine is meticulous. Although you never really see her perform the same action twice.
In the same way, at least.
In the same way. It's always framed differently. Or the first time you see the action, it's shown in its entirety. Like, you see her cooking a full meal in its entirety. But the second time you see her cooking, you just see part of it. So it highlights the repetitive nature of this routine without really showing it. Like, it lets the audience do a lot of work of filling in the blanks. But then you see that, yeah, she does have these encounters with her clients every day at the same time. And what makes her snap is less that she has, a big realization about her condition as a woman or whatnot. It's that she messes up her routine once, and that makes her entire world crumble. And that's why I mentioned earlier maybe why so many women saw themselves in this film, because it is a film that just captures the condition of a woman who is doing specifically female or women-coded tasks throughout the day, and it captures that frustration and it captures the instability of that environment. But it's so much more than that, but obviously we're not going to go into like a full 40-minute section about it.
No, we're not.
No.
Don't look at me like you want to. You mentioned they don't show her doing the same task twice, mm-hmm. in full, but what I think it does really well is, despite only really seeing her do certain tasks once, it does create the sense that this is extremely familiar.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that the audience isn't in on the whole journey of it. And I think part of that is the way Ackerman frames it and shoots it. But I think it's also Delphine Seyrig's performance. Is she plays someone that isn't miserable, but is so meticulous, I think is the perfect word.
Yeah, and what is so impressive about this film is that Chantal Ackerman was only 25 when she made it. And at the time, Delphine Seyrig was already a well-established, seasoned actor. So if you buy the Criterion DVD, which I don't know if it's available in the UK, but hopefully they're going to put some of the extras online on the Criterion channel. There's a documentary, a making-of documentary of the film, where you see the two of them interacting with each other. And you kind of see this rifting experience where, Chantal Ackerman is a kid, and you see Delphine Finsterig directing her as much as she's directing the Finsterig, and you see how much of like just the entire like behind the camera crew was entirely comprised of women. It's this film is more of a collaborative effort than people might think, and I think that's part of the reason of why it's so successful at doing what it tries to do.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way of putting it. So before we finish up, my question for you, as someone who is much more familiar with this film than me and has known about it for a lot longer, why is it so high on the list? What is its legacy on the way that the critics and filmmakers of today work?
Yeah, because I think I framed it earlier as it being on that spot mostly due to the influence of women being pulled. And while I think that's true, mainly the fact that a lot of male directors, there is a higher variety of different films that speak to them, whereas for a lot of women, like female directors and female critics, there's not much outside of Jean Dillman. So I think a lot of them maybe converge to that because of their specific demographic. But spoilers, it would be on my personal list of best films of all time, and I'm not a woman. It is kind of the film that starts slow cinema as a style in the sense that we consider it to be nowadays. So films that are completely devoid of narrative, films where an action is shown in its entirety and it's never cut. Something that became incredibly popular throughout the 90s, but I feel even more popular in art house cinema and festival cinema over the past decade. And Jean Dillman is the possibly the founder of that, or at least the big precursor of that. And also just the fact that it's a film that people who like it tend to love it, since it is a film that when you get into its rhythms, when you get into its style, it has this ability to just speak to the person and really get under your skin in the best sense possible, because you do get to spend real life time with a character, and it feels like you've been living with a person for 3.5 hours for the duration of the entire film, and that stays with you in a way that a lot of other films that maybe marvel you with their technical achievements or were just incredibly well regarded when they came out and managed to, you know, rise above the rest in terms of their critical appeal, some of those don't speak to the human condition as much. So yeah, I think Jean Dillman should be on there, with the caveat that it is not a film for everyone. It is a film that a lot of people were disappointed wasn't on there. A lot of people were disappointed was number one, not because they're misogynists, just because its style can be incredibly polarizing and alienating, and a lot of people would like to see the number one film of all time, in inverted commas, being something that is a bit more universal.
Despite the fact that we've said
that's not the point of this list
at all.
Yeah.
The list is a bit of fun.
Yeah.
That some nerds do every 10 years. Let us have it.
Yeah.
Let us be surprised. Mm-hmm. What are the Chantal Ackerman films would you recommend for people who might start with this and then want to see more of her filmography?
So that's the thing. You might not want to start with this. You might not want to jump into the 3.5 hour binge straight away. I would 100% recommend Je Tout Il Elle, which is French for I, You, He, and She, but the title isn't translated. It's her first feature film, and it does do a lot of similar things, but in a much shorter runtime. Then I would definitely recommend The Meetings of Anna, another film that is very similar in ethos to Jean Dillman, and just a lot of her shorts, because then from then on, most of her feature films end up being documentaries or video essay type films. So just if you're more interested in her ability to create a narrative, if you want to call it that, then her short films are just a gold mine, and there's like at least like a dozen of them that you can watch.
All right, well, I think that's all we have to say about that film for now. Maybe we'll talk about it more in the future. If you want to watch it, you can watch it on BFI Player in the UK, and if you're in the US, it is also available on the Criterion channel.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so that brings on to the final part of this episode, and Francesco and I have both put together, almost trying to manifest being asked one day to contribute to the Sight and Sound list, our own short collection of films that we would submit and that we wish everyone would see.
Yeah.
So, Francesco, why don't you go first?
Yeah, so a bit of a preamble. The question that people are asked, I believe, are what are the 10 greatest films of all time? So when making a list answering this question, I couldn't just talk about my personal favorites. I had to go at least pick films from different eras. I wanted to pick at least a couple silent films. I wanted to pick at least a couple contemporary films and a few in between. I wanted to pick films that are historically important, but at the same time, I really emotionally resonate with them. So, you know, didn't go for Citizen Kane, which would have been the obvious choice, because as much as I respect that film, it's not a film that is personal to me. So the list that I went with in chronological order as The Passion of Joan of Arc by Dreyer, Modern Times, Signs by Charlie Chaplin, Spring in a Small Town by Faye Mood, I spoke about earlier, Tokyo Story by Ozu, Jean Dillman by Chantal Ackerman, to no one's surprise. I went with Mirror by Tarkovsky because I wanted to put a Tarkovsky in there. I was debating Mirror and other ones, but I just went with Mirror. Satan Tango by Bellatar, even longer and more boring than Jean Dillman, if you can believe that. It's twice as long as Jean Dillman, if you can believe that. And then three contemporary choices of films that are very close and dear to me. Portrait of a Lady on Fire by Celine Sciamma, Days by Simon Yang, and Memoria by Apichatpong Weerasethi.
And of the films that you've chosen, I think seven are on the list?
Yeah.
So why don't we just talk briefly about the three that aren't on the list and, in a sentence, sum up why you think they are significant and why everyone should watch them?
Well, Spring in a Small Town, I briefly talked about it earlier, but watching the film now and thinking about the context when it was made, it is just, the camera work is spellbinding. The way that Faye Mood crafts space in his film is incredible, and it's got nothing to envy to Orson Welles. Days by Simon Yang is my personal favorite film of all time. It's another slow cinema film, and it is a film that, again, explores the daily life of two characters and the monotonous daily life of two characters until they have an emotionally charged encounter and then part ways. And I don't think I've ever seen in my life a film that has broken me emotionally quite so much. It's a film entirely devoid of dialogue where you just spend time with characters living their daily lives. And if you're an empathetic person, this film will emotionally move you like no other. But just in general, Simon Yang is my favorite director. He needed to be featured on that, and I went with Days as my favorite one. And then Memoria by Apichatpong for similar reasons. Apichatpong is one of my favorites, and I think Memoria is the apotheosis of everything he's been making over the past, over his entire career. But obviously it came out last year, so it wasn't going to be featured on the actual list because it hasn't had enough time to make its way into the canon. And it was also distributed like in a very limited way.
There isn't a Apichatpong on the list.
There's Tropical Melody, which I was surprised by it. I was expecting if any Apichatpong was going to make it, it was going to be Uncle Boomy, just because, you know, it's the one that won the Palme d'Or. But I'm happy that Tropical Melody is in there because it's a great film and it's definitely deserved.
What do you think it says about you that so many of your picks are on the list? That you think the same way as seemingly a lot of critics do?
Well, I think that there's a reason why they are on those lists in the first place. Like, it's not like, you know, a cabal of people have decided that Passion of Joan of Arc is a great film and therefore we all have to agree with it. I just think that because the question is what's the greatest film of all time, and because I forced myself not to repeat directors twice and to pick films from different eras, then especially when going in eras like the 20s and 50s, you kind of naturally fall on films that have already, you know, been canonized because those are the ones that I've seen. Whereas with contemporary films, I feel like I've seen a higher variety of them that I can make it, maybe pick more personal choices. And Portrait of a Lady on Fire being on the list, as I said, I was not expecting it at all, let alone so high. And I'm really happy that it's there because I think it's just one of the genuinely like few, almost like flawless screenplays that I've had the pleasure to see in the past few years.
Okay, so ready to go to my list?
Yeah.
My list is extremely different to Francesco. Before sending it, I asked how many do you think we might have in common? And we both went with no, but we thought we might at least have one director in common. And you thought that would be Charlie Chaplin.
Yeah, but he's the only American or English language director in my list, so...
And you chose a mostly silent film. Modern Times is one of my favourite Chaplins, but I was considering choosing The Great Dictator.
That's why I was expecting you to pick by Chaplin.
Because you know that's my favourite Chaplin. Yeah. But on balance, I thought... Which actually ties into the first on my list, which is Bringing Up Baby, which is a screwball comedy directed by Howard Hawks. The reason I chose that instead of The Great Dictator is, frankly, I think a lot of the time on lists like this, not only is comedy underrepresented, but when it is there, it's only stuff that... It's almost like it has an establishment seal of approval for you to enjoy as a comedy.
Yeah.
And that's true of Charlie Chaplin, it's true of Buster Keaton, it's true of a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a shame that so many comedies... That one of the things I love most about comedies is just hilarious dialogue. And I don't know if there's a film that does it better than Bringing Up Baby, which is a wonderful film with Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn. They won't all be this long. My only film on this list that was on the Sight and Sound list is Sunset Boulevard, mm-hmm. Billy Wilder, which is a wonderful film. I recommend you see it if you haven't. A film I talked about on this podcast, The Heartbreak Kid.
Yeah.
Which you were surprised was on the list.
I was surprised it was in your top 10. Like, I knew we both loved it. I wasn't expecting it to be quite so high.
It goes to my point of, I think that we need to reevaluate how we view comedy.
Yeah.
And again, there are a lot of great comedies from that era. I love Elaine May. I think this is her best film. I think her contribution to comedy in general is wonderful, and I just wanted to include something, and I can't think of a thing I dislike about that film.
Yeah, I think I was expecting you to maybe put Hester Street before putting The Heartbreak Kid on the list.
I love Hester Street, and I could definitely put that on the list, but I only had 10. That's part of the fun of it, is you don't get to put everything you like.
Oh, you're very limited. It's actually really hard.
Yeah. The Long Goodbye, also something I talk about on this podcast.
Yeah.
It's, I love Robert Altman. I love film noir. I love Elliot Gould being a shambolic detective. Mm. I think it's wonderful. I don't know if there's anything new I can say about The Long Goodbye that wasn't on our episode. Great film. Network, best film of all time. check it out. Sidney Lumet. There's no Sidney Lumet on this list, which is a shame. And I love this film. I think it's a great Lumet. It's a great Chayefsky who wrote it. It's wonderful performances, particularly by Peter Finch, Robert Duvall, Faye Dunaway, and William Holden. Just watch this film, and I can't wait to talk about it on the podcast in greater depth, and because you've never seen it, and I really want to know what you think of it.
I've seen the play adaptation of it with Bryan Cranston.
Was it good?
It was good, yeah. It wasn't the film, it was different, yeah.
Okay, Alien, Ridley Scott. I love this film very much, and I think it's the superior Ridley Scott sci-fi to Blade Runner.
Yeah.
Simply put. Miller's Crossing, an underrated Coen Brothers film and an underrated gangster film.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's wonderful and not enough people have seen it, and if they've seen it, they go into it expecting it to be more like The Big Lebowski or Raising Arizona and other Coen Brothers films of that era. I think it delivers on its own terms. Have you ever seen it?
No, it's one of the few Coens I haven't seen.
Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. This is a film that I don't know if anyone put on, but I think as a British person, and Sight and Sound is a British magazine, I felt the urge to include something that was quintessentially British, and to me, there is nothing more British than the 1970s and old men in coats murmuring about the Cold War.
Beans on toast.
It's very much a beans on toast spy movie. Okay, moving into even more recent, The Farewell, Lulu Wang.
Which once again surprised me, yeah.
I think that's an amazing film, and I think that it will grow in acclaim as years go on, and I totally expect to see it on the next list.
Yeah.
So I'm getting there early. And finally, Quo Vadis Aida, which is a 2020 film by Jasmila Zhbanek, which is a very moving and hard watch about the genocide in Bosnia in the 1990s. I was absolutely blown away by this film when I watched it last year. Honestly, it's a really, really powerful film, and I can't recommend it enough.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we have very different film tastes, is what this has established.
I think our homework for the break between batches 2 and 3 should be, we should each other watch the films that we haven't seen from each other's list, which makes me feel like, okay, I should probably switch Sight and Tango for something else, because I'm not going to put you through that.
They all sound like quite hard going, whereas a lot of them seem like a lot more fun.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Not that you don't like, as we've established on this podcast, you like fun.
I like fun, it's just like...
You like slow, quiet fun.
Oh, it's just, it's a question that is too difficult. Like, what are the 10 best films of all time? if people ask me, okay, why your 10 most personal films of all time, and answer something different. If people ask me what your 10 like just more most pleasurable films to watch of all time, and answer something different. So when the question is best, I kind of tend to skew towards something that is a bit more like part of the critical consensus considered already really good. So yeah. Final question. Of the individual director lists that have been posted, which one is your favorite? Not which one do you agree with the most. Which one is your favourite?
Well, I think the one going around most, and I can understand why, is S.S. Rajamouli, director of RRR, mm-hmm. one of our favourite films of this year. His favourite films are Forrest Gump, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Kung Fu Panda, Aladdin, Ben-Hur, Django Unchained, and The Lion King, as well as 2 Mel Gibson films, Braveheart and Apocalypto. It's an eclectic mix, I'd say.
Which makes sense if you've watched RRR, maybe some of his other films, but like, two Mel Gibsons, really? Like, does he not know what people are saying about him?
But I totally understand Braveheart being on that list.
Yeah.
How about you?
So my personal favorite one is A Pitch Upon Wirasata Cools, just because he's nominated things like Empire by Andy Warhol, which is an hour-long static shot of the Empire State Building, and that's it, that's what the film is. And right next to it is nominated Mad Max Fury Road and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And I think that's kind of the energy that I want to go with in a future list, if I make one in 10 years. Just that, having that range of tastes. But also, honorable mention to Tammy Liang, my favorite director, who not only copy-pasted his list from 2012 with no change whatsoever, one of his nominees both times is Goodbye Dragon Inn, directed by, do you know who?
Himself.
Himself, yeah. And you have to respect that.
You love the hustle.
Yeah.
All right, well, thank you, Francesca.
Thank you, Charlie.
As always, our artwork is by Molecule, and our esteemed producer is Jade Corbett. You can follow us online on Twitter, if it still exists, on @BCUWatchPod, and on Instagram @BCUWatchPodcast. Well, thank you again for listening.